father and household any longer. You don't need to love me. You don't need to respect me. You don't need to obey me. I'll never ask a thing of you as long as you live. But what? If I ever have anything, be it money, counsel, or blood, that'll add to your life, let me give it to you. You close the book. And nobody knew what we were talking about. And when I was able to go down to that office, knowing that the boss was going to throw me through the window, that he'd done something nice for me that I hadn't done anything for him for. So I had to go back. I had to get even with him. And I went down there, and the monkey came in to throw me through the window. And he was a German. And he was mad as anybody could be, and he was hurt clear down to his soles of his feet. And he came through that door into my place like a bull. Gonna throw me through the window. Well, fortunately, I was on the telephone, and it was his phone, and he's a frugal man. And he didn't want to throw it through the window. So while I was finishing my conversation, he moved my drafting boards out of the way so he'd have a straight shot at the plate glass window. And I hung up the phone, and he started asking. And I said, Victor, leave me alone. I don't work for you anymore. I'm down here to clean up this desk. I'm here to do the things you paid me for last year that you didn't do. And just as soon as I get even with you, I'll get the hell out of here on my own power. You'll never owe me a penny as long as you live. But for God's sake, leave me alone. I've got to get even with you. And the guy stopped in his tracks. And he says, what's happened to you, Charlie? And I says, don't know. I don't know. But if you want to know what I do know, sit down and I'll tell you. And he sat down by my desk there, and I talked to him a little while about what I was going to try to do. And he got up an hour later, crying like a baby, and he stuck out his hand. And he says, Charlie, if you're going to live like this, I want to live with you. Now, this is what I'm talking about. You see, our own peace of mind and serenity purpose cannot depend on the actions or reactions or circumstances or conditions or anything else out there. It depends only on this. My own relationship with my own God. You see? And so again and again and again, we are not dependent on the actions and reactions of others. We are not dependent on circumstances and conditions. It makes no difference what happens to me. It's my reaction to what happens to me that makes the difference. Now, I bet you 1,000 times. Huh?
The time's getting awful short. We've got more questions to answer.
Well, I'm not going to quit talking. Don't tell me. He takes all my time and then wants me to quit.
You're taking all my time. Is anyone in a hurry?
It's my reaction to what happens, you see. Don't make a bit of difference what happens to me. Now people, many, 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 many people sit there across my little table in the living room, and they'll say to me, but Chuck, you can talk like this. You've got everything. You know, it's easy for you to talk like this. But you see, when I started living this way, I didn't even have a home. This society was the only home I knew for 6 months. I didn't have two coppers to rub together. And so it isn't that you do this because you've got everything. It's that you do this and discover that the carpenter knew what he's talking about when he says, fear not, little flock. It's the Father's good pleasure. Yes, King. Next.
I would like to just add a word to that, too, because Chuck was telling you about giving me my freedom when he came into AA. But it took me years to find it out for myself. It took me years to free myself from the necessity of pleasing him or having his approval. And that was what I was trying to tell you when I told you that it took a complete upset in my life to make me get busy and find out how to live myself in spite of anything else around me.
And I also forgot to tell you that for 20 years now she's pleased me to death. Because everything she does is a plus. You know, and she does everything. And she don't have to do anything. She don't have to get up. She don't have to go to bed. She don't have to clean the house. She don't have to be there when I get there. So everything she does is a plus. You see? So you please do that.
Thank you, dear. Thank you. You see, you know, the funny side of it is that it wasn't until I quit expecting praise or pat on the back that I began to get it. As long as I was looking for it, I wasn't getting it. He would tell other people, but he never would tell me.
That's good.
So the next question is,
I'm going to live a life of a kid.
Here's a good one. I have learned to let go and let God, but how do you rid yourself of those old feelings when a word, situation, group of certain persons bring back memories we would rather forget? This thing of resentments and bitterness coming back from the past. Is that the one that's
on? No, it's just you.
You just got two? I think as this goes hand in hand with what Chuck was just saying. Because if I'm fortunate. I have a good forgetter. A lot of people don't have a good forgetter. But I am lucky, and it's nothing that I can take credit for because it's something that was inborn. I have never been able to live in the past, and I thank God for it because it's been very easy to get rid of the resentments and the bitterness of the past. And it's very difficult for me many times to pull out of my memory the feelings that I had during the years. Specific. I can give you a general idea of how I felt, but that's about all. I think when we come to realize that bitterness and resentment of something that has happened in the past over which we have absolutely no control, we can't change 1 minute or 1 second of it, then we come close to being free ourselves because the bitterness and the resentment isn't harming anybody else half as much as it's hurting us. And it's a sickness of the soul that will kill you if you keep on with it. And even though people remind you, now in Al-Anon, for instance, in order to identify with a new gal or a new guy who has definite problems at the moment, we have to be able to say, yes, I understand that because I had this experience and this is what it did to me. But when we get emotionally involved, reliving or feeling as we used to about that situation, then we're in trouble, it seems to me. And the sooner we can get rid of the resentment and the bitterness of the past and be able to take an objective view of it and say, yes, this is what happened to me, but I no longer live there. I live today. One day at a time, this moment. And I no longer, when I hit my 60th birthday, it hit me like a ton of bricks that I had many, many more years behind me than I had in front of me. And that I better jolly well not waste any of them. And that if I am not enjoying the moment, then I am living what Chuck and I like to call delayed living. And it's no good. It's just plain no good. And I like it this way. And if any one of you are bothered by bringing up situations or things of the past, perhaps if you can look at it as something over, it's happened, but it is the thing that brought you here. And without this program and without this life, we wouldn't have the tremendous living experience that we are having today. And I thank God for those years, strangely enough,
because I know that I, as a non-alcoholic, could not have found this way to live if it hadn't been for those years in hell that Jeff and I spent. And I think when you can look at it that way, it doesn't bother you so much. It happened, but it happened. Something good came out of it.
Many years ago, I was back in Fresno, and after the meeting, we had another meeting. We went out to the house. This kid was from Winston-Salem. He had a lovely wife and four or five kids. He's much younger than I. About 2 o'clock in the morning, we're out in the kitchen. He says to me, Chuck, he says, every so often I have to get drunk. I said, you do? He says, yeah. I says, why? Well, he says, I get to thinking what I did to my wife and my kids, and I can't stand it. And I have to get drunk to get rid of the hurt. I says, I don't blame you. I don't blame you. If I got to thinking about my wife and my kids, what I've done to them in the past, I'd be drunk before I get to Baker Street. I said, you don't think that there's a liquor store open between you and Baker Street. But there would be when I ran this car of mine through the front of it. So, I don't think about what I did to my wife and my kids, because the combined intelligence of the human race can't change one thought or act of yet. Nothing can be done about it. So what can I do? I can add as much as I can to their life today. And that's all I can do. That's all I can do. There is nothing else that I can do. Now, lastly, on this little subject, you know, I guess I'm a little nuts. Because I do not even believe in good or bad per se. I don't believe in it. I believe in the way it is and the way it is. When we're in left field, it appears that there is no God. When we come home, we know there is. You see. The way it is and the way it appears. Now the world would think that my 10 years in hell, and it was not nice. It was not nice. That was bad. Oh, that was bad. You know. I say it was good. Because out of the worst possible life came the best. You see? And for me, it was absolutely necessary. I never spent 1 second in hell that wasn't necessary. Because the only way I could have gotten rid of the necessity to please that ego of mine was to burn up. That's the only possibility I had. And I burned up. And out of the worst possible living experience came the best. Now, for those who may be in a little trouble with maybe their mothers or fathers or wives or somebody who thinks that there's another way, I want to give you a share of this little thing. There's only one person in the world that I felt the necessity to make see the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was my mother. I just had to share this thing with my mother. And every time we got together, we got in a fight. Thank God we didn't get together very often. But every time we got together, we got in a fight. Because mother knew the only way there was to get in the kingdom. And I hadn't done it their way. Therefore, I hadn't done it. And for 5 years, every time we got together, we got in a brawl, see? And after 5 years went by, we happened to be in my youngest brother's place in Park Ridge, Illinois. And the two of us were together, alone. And we were talking. I said, Mother, from now on until we die, I am never going to discuss anything upon which we disagree. Every time we come to a point of disagreement, I'm going to shut up. That's not because I don't like you or that I'm mad at you. It's simply that I'm not going to discuss any point upon which we disagree, because we always get in a fight. So when I shut up, you know that I love you, but I'm not going to talk anymore. And that's the way it went until I was 16 and a half years sober. And Mother and I never talked one time in 16.5 years with that person, Steve. Not once. 16.5 years went by, and Mother brought a problem of her own to me. It wasn't the bottle. It was indirectly the bottle. But it was somebody else, not her. And we sat for 2.5 hours with no curtain. And I'm telling you, it was worth the 16.5 years of sobriety. Just this, to talk with my own mother to that person. Because over the years, she had come to see that something had to have happened, you know? And she didn't understand what it was, but she knew it out. And so, you see, this is what we're thinking. This is what we're thinking. Yes. This is the way to do it. Go ahead.
That pretty well answers another question that we had. How can we Al-Anons get through to the mothers of alcoholics to let go of their son or daughter? I don't know that you can. The only thing that I know to do is to tell them a little of what this program is, give them some Al-Anon literature, and pray. And let go of them and allow them the right to find out. By just the very thing that Chet was just talking about, by the example, that something quite wonderful has happened to the alcoholic. And I know there are times when it is very difficult. Mothers and fathers have a way of wanting to protect their children from every misadventure, from every hurt. And they, in the name of love, they will try everything under the sun to keep these kids from having trouble. And they don't realize that this is a selfish love and that it takes a greater love to allow their son or their daughter to take the bump and take the result of their own actions and therefore find a way out sooner than they would if they were protected. I might tell you just one little story of this. We had one time in Beverly Hills in our Al-Anon group, three mothers. Rather a strange situation because they all three were widows. All three of them had been left enough money to take care of them all the rest of their days. And all three of them had alcoholic sons. And all three of them had spent every nickel that they possessed getting these boys out of trouble, setting them up in business, picking up bad checks, bailing them out of jail, the works. And they finally were broke, and all three of them had to go to work, and they finally found their way to Al-Anon. And one of the boys, all three of the boys, were still drinking. One of them finally committed suicide. Another one drank a bottle of cleaning fluid thinking it was vodka, and that killed him. And I have never known what happened to the third son. But you see, the thing that was so pitiful about the whole situation was this, that in the name of love, they really had contributed to their delinquency. And it's a terrible thing to even look at because they really contributed to their death. And I don't know how we can get parents to see this. I believe that maybe this is something over which we have no control also. The only thing we can do is to give them an example, to explain if they ask questions, to give them some Al-Anon literature and hope that maybe they will come and find out how to release with love and allow these kids maybe to find a shorter way through this program.
You know, I'd rather say this than anything else that I'm going to say. We as parents, having lived longer and having had more experience, think that we have a right to tell our children. From where we are, we tell them. Now, nobody on earth likes to be told. Nobody wants to be told anything. For me to sit here and tell my boy, I might as well be barking up a hollow tree because they don't want to be told. Now, the language of love has no age. The language of love has no age. I never know whether I'm talking to an Alateen group or an Al-Anon group or an AA group or oldsters or youngsters. I don't care. Because all I want to do is share. Now, the padre came in late. You know, he couldn't get up this morning. He came in late. But he's here, and I want to tell this little story. We had a padre, not this one. This one happens to be my love. You know, I'm a heathen, and he's a steady. And we get along pretty good. He lives with me down south. I'm about to convert him. But we had a padre, a beautiful man, also a member of our society. And he was talking in Palm Springs on. And I had the privilege of sitting with him, alone, yap-yapping. And he told me this little story. And it's one of the most fabulous things that I ever listened to. He was a missionary priest. And he was doing a mission in the prison at, several days he was doing this mission down there. And he says, on Monday, on Tuesday, and on Wednesday, I preached my heart out. And he says, not one man came to touch me. And he says, on Thursday night, I talked as an alcoholic at an AA meeting. And on Friday and Saturday, 50 men. 50 men came to confess. Now, what was he telling me? He was telling me that he had been preaching to these guys, telling them, for 3 days, and then he shared with us, you know. Then he shared with us, and here he said, you know. And so, in our relationship with our children, and with those around us, everybody, let's keep this in mind. We don't want to be told. We don't want to be told, but the language of our heart has no age, and we can share. We can share at their level. All of us. Because the language of love has no age. And so let's take this approach. That we share with them instead of telling them and trying to make them not make mistakes. Give them the right. Now when the boys, particularly our oldest. I had given him the right to make their own mistakes. I said, there's no father in the household. You don't need to love me, you don't need to respect me, you don't need to beg. Just let me share with you. And over the years, they would bring problems to me, particularly the oldest. And I would start right in, and I would say, Bill, this. I think this is the way I would do it. This seems to me to be the way to do it. But you don't have to do it that way. Do it your own way. And as a result, they bring pretty nearly anything to me. Up to and including this. When it came time for him to get married. He came to me one night and he said, Dad, I want you to tell me everything you know about a woman. Now, mind you, this is my own son. And so help me, we talk till daylight.
No lie.
Now, I don't know nothing about women. But we said until daylight. Now, again and again and again, I would rather you'd remember this than anything else, because it will be the most helpful in personal relations with your own kids and the people around you. We can share, but we cannot tell. God bless
you. Let's see. How can we reach the sober AA and Al-Anon members, parents of teenagers, to get their children to Alateen? Can I answer that?
Oh, again. I think that all we can do is share it first. Tell them what it is. Tell them how it affected others that we know. I'm one who is absolutely nuts about this. I don't find the present generation going to hell. Even our young members of AA, I think they're doing a better job than we are. Because so many of these youngsters, and we had one man in our group that got his first AA birthday before his 18th neighbor birthday. And he's now about 8 or 9 years old. In the focus, you know. And these guys and gals seem to find it easier to accept the fact that this is a living problem. And the bottle and the needle and the pot and the pill are symptoms, you know. I was at a meeting the other night where 3 birthdays were had. One of them was 2 years, one of them was 5 years, and one of them was 8 years, and all of them were in the 40s. And during this meeting, I guess 8 or 9 kids were on their feet, some in their 20s, some in their 30s. And nearly every one of them brought out the point that actually they hadn't come to the program to get rid of the bottle, or to get rid of the needle, or the pill, but they'd come to get rid of the big hurt. And in my country, they don't mind saying something like this. And it's just, I can feel it with them. They talk about standing on the street corner with a big hole in their guts and the wind blowing through. I know what they're talking about, you know. But they came to the program and they got rid of the big hurt. So they recognize it as a living problem. Much quicker and easier. Some of us oldsters think as long as we're not drunk, we're sober. You know? But again, sobriety is the ability to live comfortably and peacefully and joyously with me. And until I can do that, I haven't got sobriety, you know? And so again and again and again, we can share, we can tell them what these kids are fighting. And by George, some of the real early teenage kids are finding answers that curl my hair. That's fabulous. And maybe just that will be enough. Maybe it won't be, but again, that's all we can do. That's all we can do. You see, I can't go out and save the world. I can share with those around me, you know. In a little circle. And I'm reminded of this, and I've got to tell it. It takes a little time, but it can't help it. I used to know a chap who went around the world with Douglas Fairbanks Sr. on the trip where he spent time with all the kings and the princes and the holy men of the world, practically. This chap's name was Alan Boone. He was a remarkable guy, non-alcoholic newspaper man. But he used to come to our program because he loved it and loved what he found here. And he was telling about a conversation they'd had with a holy man of China. And they talked about the great problems of the world and came late and it was about time to quit. So Doug Fairbanks Sr. says to this holy man, he says, how are we going to change these systems? How are we going to change these systems? And the guy sort of smiled, and he says, we're not. He says, we can't change systems. Individual purification is the only answer. Individual purification. So we share with those around us. And it's like a wave on the ocean, you know. And when enough people change, the system will change. And you and I have got to see this. We'd love to go out and just clean up Grant Pass, you know. Yeah. Get them all in here, and if they won't do it, get their heads and knock them together. We got some good. Now get in here. Mm-hmm. But it don't work that way. individual purification and sharing as we can, and again letting the ship forward in it. Is that the only way to do that?
Here's a question. When both husband and wife are alcoholics, would you recommend Al-Anon for the wife, or is the AA program advice, or is the AA program sufficient? Well, I'll give you my own opinion, and I'll tell you what we're doing down south, and that's all I can do. Many, many alcoholics who are married to alcoholics come to Al-Anon also in conjunction with their AA meetings, because, in effect, they have exactly the same problem that we do, learning how to live with another alcoholic. And it's very helpful to them. Now, they keep the two separate, because they are two separate entities, but it is extremely helpful. And for the last 6 or 7 years, we have had a monthly luncheon meeting going in Balboa of a joint meeting of AA and Al-Anon women. Now, these are not necessarily the wives of practicing alcoholics. Some of them are and some of them aren't. But if you would go into that meeting and didn't know who was which, you couldn't tell. Because we are trying to find the same answers through the same identical program. And they are living answers and living problems. And it's a terrific thing. And it has formed a bridge between the Al-Anon and the AA woman. It is one of the most terrific things that I have ever seen. And it was so successful that they have started one in Glen Park now. And it is going strong. And they have anywhere from 45 to 50 women at that meeting every month. And it's quite a thing, and I have a feeling that it will grow. But the thing, we must remember that these are two separate programs. And when we take a collection in that meeting, we divide it and send half to AA and half to Al-Anon, because AA cannot accept money from Al-Anon, and Al-Anon cannot accept money from AA or from any outside source. So, but we are cooperating. We are getting together and finding out that we have almost essentially the same problem of learning how to live. And we share with each other, and we help each other. And it's quite terrific. There are a lot of AAs who have quite a little resentment of Al-Anon, I think mainly because they do not understand what the program is, and they think we go there to talk about them. But this is not true. This is not true. We go there to do something about ourselves. You want to say anything on that as well?
Again, there's not two answers.
It's all the same.
They're not two answers. There's not one answer for me, a drunk, and another for you, a non-alcoholic. It's all the same answer, and I blush a little. Because in the family relations department, now understand, I do not think of myself as a marriage counselor, a family relations expert, or a psychiatrist, or a doctor, or a priest. But in the family relations department, Al-Anon is doing a better job of our program than we are. We drunks come into this program with the excuse of the bottle. And oftentimes, think when we have no longer have the bottle in our lives, we've got all the answers. But the Al-Anon comes right off the bat to find living answers, you know? And in many, many cases, they're doing a much better job with it than we are. And this we should not have to admit. But it seems to me to be true. Yeah, I think that it's good, both for the alcoholic husband and the alcoholic wife, to get a little Al-Anon in with their AA. I think it's very good. And again, it's not different. It shouldn't be different. It should be the same thing.
Here's a cutie that often comes up in Al-Anon. How do you get over the feeling that you would like to go out and have a good time when your spouse is working the program? You know, many alcoholics, after their wives or their husbands have been going to Al-Anon for a while, get a little resentful of us because they think we're getting to be too blasted independent. If you're like me, you have become a complete and utter nothing. In fact, many of us become complete and utter doormats. And you heard Chuck say last night, those of you that were at the meeting, that the alcoholic dislikes weakness worse than poison. And you know, it's a funny thing, but during the drinking years, the alcoholic seems to have to tear you down until you begin to get the feeling that you're worthless, you're useless, that you don't amount to anything. And it took me many, many years to understand why they do this. But I think I understand it now. It is because of their own self-condemnation, their own hurt. They have to tear somebody else down in order to build themselves up. And we do this too. And it has a chain reaction about it that is real bad, because they tear us down, and then we turn around and tear our kids down. And then our kids go out and tear their friends down. And this seems to be the way it works.
Kick the dog.
Kick the dog. Yeah, that actually happened. One of our girls in our group went home one night from a meeting, feeling real good after a meeting. She still had a practicing alcoholic husband. And she was cooking dinner, and everything was cooking merrily on the stove, and he came in, much the worse for wear, feeling absolutely no pain. And he said, "Where are the car keys?" And she said, "They're over there in my purse." And he went over and got her purse and brought it over to the stove and dumped the entire contents in the food that was cooking on the stove. Well, you can imagine what her reaction was. Her little girl was standing right behind her, and she turned around and hit her little girl with her elbow. And the little girl looked at that real startled and ran in the other room and kicked her brother. And the little brother, not knowing what was going on, ran out in the yard and kicked the dog. Yeah. And here's one more story that I want to tell you. I know Chuck's wanting me to tell it because I think it's one of the cutest things that ever happened in our group. We have a gal that is very, very southern, and she's got the most terrific sense of humor I ever saw in all my life. And she had a practicing alcoholic at home, and he objected very strenuously to her going to Al-Anon. And this one day, she asked him for the keys to the car, and he said, "Why in the hell do you want to go to that meeting?" And she turned around to him very calmly, and she said, "I am going to that meeting to find a way so that I won't have to kill you." He handed her the keys, and he's never objected since. So. This thing of how do you get over the feeling that you would like to go out and have a good time. Alcoholics have a way of getting so involved in this program and with its work that it seems to many of us that we never have an opportunity to do the things that we enjoy doing, like going to a show or going to a concert or having a party with our friends or something of the sort. And this is just my own personal opinion. My husband has said to me many times, I have gripes about this a little bit, and he said, "Any time that you want to get tickets for this or that, I'll go." So do you think I go and get the tickets? No. I sit there and feel sorry for myself and say, I wish he'd get on the ball and get some tickets, and I don't do anything about it myself. Or, if I'm in a different mood entirely, and I choose to go to a show, or to go to see some friends or go to a meeting or anything else, I go. And lately, in the last few years, if you told me 10 years ago that I would accept an engagement to talk in some other part of the country when he wasn't invited and would accept it and go and leave him home alone, I would have said you were crazy. Because I would be so afraid that he would disapprove of this and that he wouldn't it makes me feel guilty, and et cetera, et cetera. And the fun part of it is, the first time I accepted one of these engagements, he was all for it and was just as sweet and dear about it as he could be. And now I feel free to go when I choose to accept one of these engagements because I am an individual too, you see. And most of this I was thinking he was thinking when he wasn't thinking it at all. And we have a tendency to say, oh, if I do this, he'll do that. If I say this, he'll say that. And it may not be true at all. He may not be thinking the way we think he's thinking at all. But when we do something with a sense of guilt, they know it and they react accordingly. And I don't know, maybe I'm too independent. Am I?
No.
I think I'm doing a better job.
No, once you get out of town. Well, that's the way the mice will play.
I know this, that I have to be comfortable with me. And in order to be comfortable with me, I have got to do my end of the deal. This is a marriage. My husband works hard to make a living. I try to keep things going at home. And unless I am doing as good a job as I know how to do, I am uncomfortable with me. And I think Chet will agree with me that I am doing a better job as a housewife and as a wife than I have ever done in my life before. I used to be a lousy housekeeper. Lousy housekeeper. But I think I am doing a better job than I've ever done in my life. I know I am more comfortable with me than I have ever been. And I feel freer than I have ever felt. And I think that Chuck will agree with me that we have more mutual respect than we have ever had before. And this is a good way to live. Am I right or wrong?
That's the last question.
That's the last
question. I want to talk a little bit. Yeah, I'm going to do it because you're not hungry. You just had breakfast. I got to say this because it's freedom. It's freedom. The thing that brings it to my mind is coming in from Bert's the other night, Friday night, I think, when we came down to this meeting. We saw a number of deer. Now, I love deer. I just love deer. One of the reasons I live in Laguna Beach is so I can go through the Laguna Canyon back and forth to my work. And I so often see deer. And I love them. And I invariably look for them where I saw them last. You know? And I invariably see them someplace else. And a few years back, I'm going through the canyon. And I'm out of the area where you could possibly see a deer. There's no deer up here because it's open country. And it's maybe 9:30 in the morning. And good self-respecting deer wouldn't be out at 9:30 in the morning anyhow, you know. And I look up, and right out there in the open field is the most beautiful big buck you ever saw. Well, it started me thinking. You don't see them where you think they ought to be. You see them where they are. You see them where they are. And for the next hour, as I drove down, I had more fun with this than anything that you can imagine. Because it went through the whole gamut of human relations. Our own proclivity of putting labels on things and people. We categorize everybody, you know. We categorize our own wife. We know exactly what she's going to do under certain circumstances. We know what she's going to think, you know. So we got to categorize. So she's then of no interest to us. Because we know what she's going to do and what she's going to think. We categorize everybody else. We got ex-cons, ex-metal patients. And we categorize them, and they categorize each other and themselves. And it's the most trifling, the most binding thing on the face of the earth, to categorize. It takes all the interest out of life. You see them where they are. You don't see them where you think they ought to be. Now, I was up here 6 years ago. But nobody in this room ever saw me before. Nobody ever heard me before. Because I am not the man of that year 6 years ago. I am what I was then, plus the experience and the lesson of life for the last 6 years. I'm not the man I was yesterday. I'm the man that woke up yesterday morning plus yesterday's experience and its lesson. You see? And when we come to see this, when we get rid of the necessity to categorize anybody, when we come to see that our own wife is a new woman every morning when she wakes up, what a thing it is. You meet a new person every morning. And as the interest and the value in the relationship is infinite. It's absolutely infinite. It's fabulous. And lastly, I want to tell you this. And I'll bawl. And I don't care. You know how long it's been since I've seen a drunk? It's been over a dozen years since I ever saw a drunk. Now, my plant is at 40th and Alameda. And every time I go downtown, if I have time, I go to the head of 5th Street and go west, because that's our Skid Row. If I got time, it just draws me like a magnet. Down I go, and I head right down 5th Street. And almost every time I turn into that place, the Black Mariah is coming from some angle or another. Well, I know that Black Mariah inside out. I've ridden in her in chains, you know. And the man on the street knows her too. And he knows the rag picker is sitting right there, and they're going to pick him up. And here's a little wino, and he's drunk as a skunk, you know. And he's got a fist of wine and a brown paper bag so nobody will know what he's got. And he sees this paddy wagon coming, this Black Mariah. And he starts trying to make it in the alley. And he can't make it hard. He goes down about 6 times, but does he break that wine? No! He breaks his paddy, but he don't break the wine. And he gets into the alley, and I thank God. Thank God, because you see, that's me. That's me, but with the grace of God. That's me, but with the grace of God. And I go on down the street, and here sits the old boy in the doorway. And it's July, and he's got his black overcoat on. And he's got a fifth of red eye sitting right there by him, half full, see. And he's laughing, and he's talking with his friends and having a hell of a time. And they're not there. You know, his friends aren't there. And I can't hardly drive by. I want to leave that car sitting right in the middle of 5th Street. And get out and go over there and pick that old boy up and sit him on my lap and rock him to sleep. Because you see, that's me. But with the grace of God. I used to wear my overcoat in July. I used to meet the people and talk to them. When they weren't there. I think one of the toughest things my family ever had to put up with. So often, we'd all be in the same living room, and I'd have company, and they wouldn't have any, you know. And they couldn't understand it. And so again and again and again. See, that's me, but with the grace of God. Right underneath that crud is God's kid, even as you and I. You see? And so we come to see ourselves in all men and all men in themselves. And there's no necessity of categorizing anybody. I don't know any ex-cons. I don't know any ex-metal patients. I don't know any ex-anything. I know God's kids with brothers. God's kids with brothers. And so we share best we can with what we got. And lastly, I want to tell you all, this has been a happy, happy weekend for us. I love your country. I'll take you back with me. You know, I need you much worse than you need me. Because, you see, you are many, and I'm one. And so, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you I love you. And I'll take you with me, and I'll pray, my God, that you remain constant in growth, and grow, and live in joy. God bless you all. Thank you very much.